Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Klaas Douwe Dijkstra, K-L-A-A-S-D-O-U-W-E-D-I-J-K-S-T-R-A. He was born in the Netherlands, but grew up in Egypt, drawing and describing his first dragonflies when he was 12 years old. Finding the Netherlands' first vagrant emperor dragonfly, an African visitor, focused his passion when he was 20. He's since spent over 1,000 days surveying dragonflies all over Africa and has described 78 species as new, over 10% of those known on the continent. 60 species were described in one paper in 2015 to draw attention to the lack of support for taxonomy and natural history. He authored the highly successful Field Guide to the Dragonflies of Britain and Europe, 2006, The Dragonflies and Damselflies of Eastern Africa, Handbook for All Odonata from Sudan to Zimbabwe, 2014, and is an honorary research associate at the Naturalis Biodiversity Center, the Netherlands, and the University of Stellenbosch in South Africa. He says, and I love this, "For me, dragonflies and damselflies stand for our unconditional love of nature. They do not help to feed us like bees and fish do. They are not feared and persecuted like mosquitoes and snakes, nor are they studied as proxies of human psyche and society like ants and apes. Their beauty and sensitivity stand for the state and needs of nature before our own. We admire dragonflies purely for what they are." So first, thank you for your work, and thank you for your love of dragonflies. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's start by just talking about who and what dragonflies are. I think we're all sort of familiar with them, but can you talk more about them generically?
Yeah, so dragonflies and damselflies are a group of insects. There are about 6,000 species. 3,000 of those are dragonflies, 3,000 of those are damselflies. And they're an order of insects found only by fresh water. So all of them have larvae that need fresh water to survive and that emerge from the water as adults to reproduce. I think that is basically the essence of dragonflies.
And I live right next to a pond, and I get in the pond all the time. I look at the pond, and I see dragonfly larvae all the time, and see dragonfly adults. And so, can you tell me, like, my understanding is that dragonfly larvae can live for a long time, and I guess they're not called larvae, but dragonfly babies can live for a long time underwater, and then they live for a fairly short time out of water. Is that correct?
Not entirely. So we call them larvae, typically. Some people call them nymphs. And how a dragonfly develops, it comes from an egg, and then the larva, to grow, needs to shed its skin several times, just like a snake would, so it can expand. And it'll do that perhaps, 10 times. It varies a bit. And eventually the dragonfly, or actually the larva, will come out of the water, shed its skin one more time, and then the adult dragonfly, so the winged creature, is already packed inside that larva. So all it needs to do is shed its skin, pump it up its body, pump up its wings, and harden out a little bit, and fly away. So there's not a pupal stage as there is, for example, in butterflies. Now, people very often ask how long, does a dragonfly live for? And that really depends very much on the species, and you really have to look at it separately. You have to look at how long the larva lives, and you have to look how long the adult lives. Because some species, for example, live in very cold water where there's almost nothing to eat. So they may use years and years to become so large that they can emerge and fly away as a dragonfly. So they may live as a larva for several years, maybe 5 years. Other species are adapted to very seasonal conditions. So, for example, they breed in a rain puddle that will dry up in a few months' time. So they can maybe just take 4 weeks to develop as a larva. So there's a big difference there. And it's the same with the adults. Some species, they emerge, let's say, somewhere in late summer in the north. So it's going to be a short summer. They need to get on with business, reproduce as quickly as possible. So a few weeks is the maximum. Whereas other species that, again, live, for example, in very seasonal environments, they may need to wait for another year before it rains again, and so actually have to live for a year until that happens. So on the whole, you can say perhaps the average dragonfly lives for 1 or 2 years as a larva and then for a few weeks as adults, but there's a lot of variation.
And I remember reading somewhere, I don't know if this is true, but I remember reading somewhere about how some dragonflies migrate. And once again, we're describing a huge variation of creatures, but first, what is the range of, once again, typical, using that word advisedly, what is the range of many dragonflies and individuals? And then also, do some of them have migrations?
Yes. So the range, again, is incredible. So some species are found only in one river system, one stream system, one mountain range. Other species are found almost all over the world. Wherever there is fresh water on the planet, you will find dragonflies. And there's one species in particular, which is known as the wandering glider, or also known as the globe skimmer, which can be found in standing waters, temporary waters like rain puddles, in almost every continent. It's even found on Easter Island. The only place actually that it's not occurring is Antarctica and most of Europe for some reason. And that is the species that migrates in a spectacular way. That species migrates annually across the Indian Ocean. And this happens because once the monsoons are over in India, there are no more puddles. They've all dried up for it to reproduce in. And this species needs to cross over to the other half of the Earth, to the other hemisphere, where it will be summer in half a year's time, to again profit from the monsoons. But it can't go anywhere because south of India there's just ocean. So to complete the cycle, to find new habitat to breed in, that species actually needs to cross the Indian Ocean to Africa, and there the new generation will breed in the pools there. And once it's time, once they've emerged, they have the same problem. So they either will have to migrate north to the other side of Africa to reproduce there, or migrate over to India. So, and there are other species that migrate, perhaps not in such a spectacular fashion, because this is probably the most spectacular migration among insects. But there are quite a few species that can fly very far, and quite a few species have large ranges.
So okay, where I live in far northern California on the coast, there is a goose, the Aleutian goose, who will fly nonstop from here up to the Aleutian Islands. And it's an extraordinary migration in terms of flying continuously for about 2 weeks. Obviously, there's no place for them to stop and rest. And when you tell me about that migration right there, that makes, in my mind, that's way more strenuous than the Aleutian geese migration, because these are tiny little creatures. And they're flying how many miles about?
I wouldn't even know the exact distance. But yeah, we're talking about a couple thousand kilometers that they need to cross the open ocean. And the calculations are that they can cover the distance in about 6 days. And that sounds incredibly fast, and that is because they have help. So the periods that they need to cross over from India to Africa is a period of favorable winds. So they actually, and this is all actually based on circumstantial evidence, because the thing is, they are so small that it's actually very difficult. With the geese, for example, you can use radar to see where they're moving. But with these insects, you can't. So this is based on observations of stragglers showing up on islands in between, and the timing of that, which suggests that these migrations happen. But the thing is that it happens exactly then when the weather system is perfect, so when they have the winds in the back. And the other thing is, although they are small, they are light, and they're well-equipped. They're extremely good flyers. So probably they don't even need to use too much energy to make this crossing, because they have the support from the wind. They are extremely effective gliders. And so probably it's not as spectacular as, from our perspective, as earthbound creatures, as it might seem.
Nonetheless, whenever I hear something like this, it always, the way the natural world works always fills me with awe. I mean, it's just,
of course,
it's just,
yeah.
It's just wonderful how that all works, and they glide on the wind. That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, I was just saying that's the beauty of adaptation.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we talk about threats to dragonflies or long-term population trends in dragonflies, can we talk for just a moment about dragonflies in the far, far, far distant past? Because weren't there at one point in the history of the planet gigantic dragonflies?
Yes. So about 250, 300 million years ago, there were dragonflies that had wingspans of perhaps 2 feet. And these were, I mean, they looked generally like a dragonfly. So they had the long wings, they had the long body, but they were not closely related to the dragonflies that we have now. So we don't even know exactly how they fit in the evolutionary tree of the dragonflies. They're quite different, but they're definitely dragonflies. We do know, though, that, you know, those were very different times. Oxygen levels were much higher in the atmosphere at the time, which might make it easier for oxygen to be transported through the bodies of an insect. That actually makes it possible for an insect to get so large. And another factor is that there probably weren't large predators at the time, such as pterodactyls, you know, pterosaurs, birds, and such. So there was also actually a niche that was available to them then that's not available to them now. So yeah, you have to keep in mind these were very different. They were gigantic, they were spectacular, but they were quite different from the dragonflies, the equally spectacular dragonflies we see today. And in a very different time as well than we have today.
So also, before we talk about trends in dragonflies, can you talk a little bit about their ability to just some of the amazing things about them, such as their vision, their ability to concentrate and focus on one creature, and their ability to predict where that creature's movements are taking them, etc.?
Well, I mean, probably the most amazing thing about dragonflies is their flight. So it's their just their ability to maneuver in flight. The amazing thing is that dragonflies are definitely among you know, one of the oldest groups of flying insects. The other group is the mayflies, which are actually very weak flyers. But most insects that fly that we're familiar with evolved later. But still, the amazing thing is actually that the dragonflies are the best flyers of them all. So in a way, the way of flying that dragonflies have developed has never been improved. And one of the things that is very unusual about dragonflies, and that you don't see in other insect groups, is that dragonflies have the ability to, they have four wings, so two pairs of wings, like all insects do. But unlike most insects, they can actually move all four wings independently. So in most most insects, they will use like they will be flopping with synchronously, like butterflies do, for example. But dragonflies can move the four independently, which means that they can do anything that they desire. They can stand still. They can fly backwards, up and down. So they have this incredible maneuverability. And of course, that is very important because all dragonflies are predators. So all of them hunt other animals, mostly other insects. And to intercept those, they need the maneuverability, and of course, they need really good vision because they're visual hunters. So they combine this incredible capacity of flight with a very, very large and very acute eyes. An eye of a dragonfly can have about 29,000 omatidia, which is, you know, all the facets that an insect eye has, which together each facet is like a pixel of a picture, which together forms an image. We've also found out recently that dragonflies have about 7 color receptors in their eyes, whereas humans have only 3. We don't know if all 7, you know, make also a much more colorful image, but we do know that possibly their color vision is better than ours. So yeah, these are really the two things that are extremely well developed in dragonflies.
I know you just said that we don't know really what it means, but I'm interested in the thing about the seven color receptors, because I used to be a beekeeper, and so I know that honeybees, for example, see red as black. They don't see infrared, and they do see ultraviolet, so the world looks completely different to them. Does the fact that they have seven color receptors, that mean that it would just be more vivid, or does that mean that they see the world really completely differently?
I think we haven't actually figured that one out yet. At least I don't know. I can't answer the question. So either I haven't read my literature properly, or we just haven't gotten that far yet.
Hmm. That's, once again, it's just extraordinary to me, your line about adaptation. I mean, the world is just extraordinary. Okay, I want to go a different direction now. And several years ago, there was a dragonfly expert came and gave a talk here locally, and probably the most the question that was most that most of the people in the audience wanted to know is, why are there fewer dragonflies and than there used to be? And I've lived here for 17 or 18 years now, and in this time I have seen a dramatic decline in the population of dragonflies here. Probably it used to be on a warm summer day I might go out and see, at any time over the pond I would see 100 dragonflies, and now on a warm summer day, I might see 10 or 15 or 20. And is this just local, or is this happening across the world?
Again, we actually have very little data. So you often hear these kind of stories, and people do say, yeah, I'm seeing fewer dragonflies than I did in my childhood. But the truth is that we actually have very little data to substantiate that. The problem there is that, you know, of course you can anecdotally, you know, observe that numbers have declined, but only recently have dragonflies become so popular that actually we have the amount of volunteers that can go out and actually observe dragonflies, actually count dragonflies, and see what the trends are. And then actually we see again a very complicated picture. For example, in the Netherlands, where I'm from, I live in South Africa at the moment, but in the Netherlands where I'm from, actually a lot of species are increasing, and actually a lot of species are profiting from global warming. So you know if you then kept your vision very narrow, some people might say, oh well, you know, dragonflies, they like a warm climate, so actually they're benefiting. And it's true, some species, for example species that are from Africa, these tropical species, they will profit, and because they're good dispersers, they will extend and their numbers will increase in Europe. But we see other species, for example those of bogs, you know, which is a boreal habitat, which dry out easily, that are affected negatively, and the numbers are declining. Where we really see dragonflies suffering is in standing waters. In flowing waters. So typically the species of streams and rivers are much more sensitive. They're often also much more localized species. And such species are very easily affected by erosion, by damming, because of course a dam will turn a stream into a lake. So that completely changes the environment. The removal of natural vegetation, or the development of alien vegetation, which may shade out a habitat. The introduction of trout in many areas where it's not native. Trout are a predatory fish. So that can affect the dragonflies. So there are multiple reasons why dragonflies decline. But the biggest problem in general, as for almost all threatened species, is habitat destruction. So it's the changing of river courses. So it's damming, it's canalizing river system, it's draining ponds, it's draining marshes, wetlands. So the general destruction of freshwater habitats.
And how sensitive are dragonflies to pollutants in the water?
They tend to be, on the one hand, dragonflies are top predators. So on the one hand, you have, you know, they're at the top of the food chain, often in the environments that they inhabit. So on the one hand, that means, of course, that the pollutants will accumulate in dragonflies. On the other hand, that does mean also that they need to be adapted to some degree to pollution. So we see with dragonflies that they can be sensitive to chemical pollution, but some other groups in freshwater, such as, for example, mayflies and caddisflies, they are actually even more sensitive to this kind of pollution. What dragonflies, on the other hand, are extremely sensitive to is structural habitat change. So it's changing the clarity of the water, for example, changing the substrates, so from a sandy substrate to a muddy substrate, for example, and all these kind of changes that are influenced by human actions, like damming, like erosion, like agriculture, like the removal of vegetation. These are the kind of things that dragonflies respond very, very sensitively to.
So this raises a couple questions, and I'm sorry if a lot of these questions are so basic, but I mean, I love dragonflies and I don't know them, so I'm presuming audience members won't know either. Are larvae, how do they hunt? I've seen them hunt, but are they visual also, or how do they detect prey?
So mostly it's visual and it's tactile. So it depends again a bit on the species. So if you are a species that is crawling around in water plants, then you can imagine that, you know, the water is clear around you and you're mostly a visual hunter. If you are digging in the mud, there's not much to see anyway because you're stuck with your head in the mud. So then a tactile strategy, looking for little worms, for example, in the mud, will be better. So that, again, depends on the species.
And also, the dragonflies I'm most familiar with are those who lay their eggs in a pond, and they seem to just drop their egg into... They drop their behind into the pond and release an egg, presumably. How does that work in a flowing water? Because it never occurred to me before. How do they do it in a stream to not have the egg carried away? Do they attach it?
Yes. Yes, that happens. So again, there are multiple strategies. So some species, like the ones, indeed, many of the species, especially the dragonflies that breed in ponds, they tend to just drop them in the water surface. They drop to the bottom and develop there. In running water, many species have sort of anchors on the eggs. So they'll have like a gelatinous spiral, for example. So something that can catch onto vegetation or even glue to vegetation. And all the damselflies, so you know, remember I said there's this important distinction in the entire group between dragonflies and damselflies. All damselflies actually cut openings in vegetation, so they have a drill-like structure at the females at the tip of the abdomen called an ovipositor, and they make a little slit in the vegetation and they put an egg in there. So that means that the egg is relatively protected and secure in that little slit. So yeah, there's lots of different strategies there as well. Some species, for example, have a spike with which they position the eggs in the mud under the water surface.
And when I think about dragonflies, one of the first things I think about is their just dramatic variation of color. And are there Why are some dragonflies like deep scarlet and some are bright blue? What advantages do those give them?
It's the same reason that birds are colorful. These are males trying to impress females and trying to impress each other. And dragonflies, you know, much more so than many other animal groups and very similar to birds, are extremely visual. And of course, humans are also extremely visual. And so we see and we appreciate that kind of color. But that diversity we see is all, of course, about impressing each other.
We originally got in contact because you wrote to me to thank me for referencing the Amani flatwing in a book. So it's one of the most endangered species in the world. Can you talk about the Amani flatwing for a moment?
Yeah, it's not only endangered, but it's also extremely unusual in the sense that it seems to be... So just to tell you, yeah, a little the listeners a little bit about this species. So this is a damselfly, which is only known
Can you back up a second?
Yeah?
And you haven't defined the difference between a dragonfly and a damselfly. Can you define the difference?
Okay, yeah. Sure. So as I said, there are about 6,000 species in the order Odonata, the insect order Odonata. There are about 6,000 species, 3,000 dragonflies, 3,000 damselflies. Generally, the dragonflies tend to be a bit more robust, and they tend to hold the wings open when perched. And damselflies tend to be more slender, and they tend to have the wings closed when they're perched. There are exceptions, so if you want to be really sure, what you should look at is this. The dragonflies, the scientific name is Anisoptera, which means Anisoptera means unequal wings. So if you look, the forewings and the hindwings are different because the hindwings are wider. If you look at a damselfly, the scientific name is Zygoptera. A zygon is a yoke, like, you know, that you would use to carry water, so it's balanced, which indicates that all four wings are balanced. They're all equal. And the other thing you can look at is the eyes. A dragonfly has larger eyes that sort of enclose the head, they envelop the head, whereas damselflies, they have slightly smaller eyes which are at opposite ends of the head. So it's more like with a hammerhead shark. The head is in between the eyes. So generally, you can just see it by the position of the wings and by the general slenderness. But if you want to be really sure, just look at those wings and eye details.
So you were talking about the Amani flatwing, and I interrupted you.
Yeah. So this is a damselfly that is only known from the East Usambara Mountains, which is a mountain range in Tanzania. And this is a part of a very ancient mountain range in Tanzania called the Eastern Arc. And the Eastern Arc has all sorts of animals living there that are found nowhere else in the world. And the Amani flatwing is one of those. And at the moment, it's only known to be found at one stream. This mountain range is very densely populated. It's a very lush, very fertile area. So people are also, very comfortable there, just like the dragonfly. And most of the forest there has been cleared for agriculture. And this species also doesn't go very high up into those mountains, which means, you know, as people encroach from the bottom into the mountains, the forest that disappears first is the forest at the bottom, which is exactly where the species occurs. But what is even more special about this damselfly, it's not just any rare damselfly, it's also a damselfly that we don't even know where its closest relatives live. So for most damselfly species, you would have one species, and then the next mountain range you would have something similar, and you know, there would be a whole family of related species. But with this particular damselfly, we have no clue what its nearest relatives are. It might, you know, we're still researching it, but it might actually be a unique family of dragonfly. So not only is it endangered, but it's also probably represents an ancient story. It's like a living fossil. It tells us something about what the African environment was like millions of years ago. And so if we lose that species, we don't just lose a species, but we actually lose a part of evolutionary history of this group. So, that's what makes it special. That's why it was nice that you referenced it.
And how many individuals do they think there are of those, and how big is there, how much habitat is remaining to them?
So the stream, I'm actually very unfortunate myself. I've been to the site, but I've actually never seen the animal because I was there in the wrong time of year. And I tried very hard to find the larvae because, you know, to find the larva would be a fantastic way to find out, something more about it, about what it's related to, because it will give us more information. But I couldn't. But what you do notice is that it's just a tiny stream. It's a small rocky stream. It's maybe a kilometer long, but probably the section that the species is on is a couple hundred meters. And, well, we have an estimate. I think you cited it. It was something like 500 individuals. But the thing is, it's almost impossible to know because there is no one out there counting these individuals, going to look every day in the season when they're flying to see how many are there. And even if someone did, to really know how many species there are, you would have to count how many are emerging from the water, or you would have to do a study marking individuals to see how many different ones there are. So that is a very wild guess. So to be honest, there could be 10, there could be 1,000. All we know, and we've tried to look for it at other streams at higher elevations, but this is the only stream that is in pristine forest at this elevation that we know of. So as far as we can tell, it's only there.
So I interviewed a couple months ago someone who works on fireflies, and one of the things they're doing in the United States is he actually is in charge of this, that he set up a program where people go outside for 10 minutes and they record the number and color of firefly flashes that they see, and that is starting to provide a larger database of firefly population estimates and trends. And is there anything even remotely resembling that, any sort of citizen reporting system for dragonflies, or is that even a possibility that something like that could start to be set up?
There's actually a lot of that going on. So I would say that I might even dare to say that dragonflies are among the insects, the darlings of citizen science, and that is because they are beautiful, they are popular. Many species are relatively easy to identify, and citizen science has increased in general. There are many websites all over the world, like iNaturalist and iSpots and Observation.org, and in South Africa we have the virtual museums that are collecting records, not just of dragonflies, but of butterflies, of birds, of basically anything we can get. And we see that dragonflies are very often a target group in these kind of initiatives, because they are a group, and especially an insect group and a freshwater group, that we can use to bring the public in, to draw their attention to nature and to observe. And so we are collecting thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of records through all these different portals. Now, and the problem is actually we're getting more data than the experts that are working on the dragonflies can handle. So we really hope we can make the best of the data we get and serve the people that are serving us. It's extremely important. It's in a way it's become the foundation of dragonfly research. It's the volunteers out there collecting all the records.
That's great. I'm going to go a different direction again, and when you were talking about various threats to dragonflies, with primarily dam building and changing the physical structure of the stream or pond, there's another thing that I've been wondering about just here locally, is that the pond that I'm most familiar with has fewer frogs in it than there used to be. Because the ozone layer, the depletion of the ozone layer allows more UVB through, that weakens some of the egg sacs of some of the species, and so fewer of the baby, and so more of a mold called Saprolegnia gets in and eats the babies. So that population is going down. And my point is that something I used to see just scads and scads of tadpoles, and there are fewer now. And the point is that the dragonflies eat the tadpoles, and we know that amphibians are undergoing just worldwide collapse. And so my question is, does that constitute a significant enough reduction in their prey to also affect the populations of dragonflies? Do you see what I'm asking?
I see what you're asking. As far as I know, no research has been done, or any evidence has been gathered that something like that is happening. There is, of course, a very intricate relationship between dragonfly numbers and frog numbers, because yes, Of course, some species of dragonflies will be, you know, will predate as larvae on these tadpoles. But then the adult frogs themselves are also often eating the dragonflies. So there's a complicated, in a way, if, you know, if there are lower numbers of frogs, that might actually also benefit the dragonflies, or at least some species in those ponds. But as far as I know, there is no evidence to state, you know, that there is such a relationship. But of course, it's very well possible, because if anything is true about the natural world, it is that we know almost nothing about it, and we know our impact on it is massive, but we don't know how massive that impact is, and we often almost don't care to know, as humans, how dramatic our impact is.
So, I'm always uncomfortable asking this question, but it still seems an important question. And then the question is what are the, we know that dragonflies are predators, but what happens? What would be some of the effects in terms of an unraveling of a forest or a meadow, if dragonfly populations were to either collapse or to change? Like, I know that salmon are incredibly important nutrient pumps into a forest, that they bring in just tons, literally, of nutrients from the ocean up to the forest. And what are some of the important roles that dragonflies can play in their natural communities? Like, do they, and not just for us, but for all of them, do they, when they eat, do they eat tiny little bugs like mosquitoes as well as larger creatures?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the first thing I can think of. So dragonflies are indeed all predators. And typically, yeah, when people think of possible impacts of having fewer dragonflies around, one of the major ones can be, and I think there's a little bit of evidence. There's actually not as much evidence as you would expect, but there is some evidence. That this is true, and that is that dragonflies are major predators of, basically they will eat anything they can get. And that can include mosquito larvae, and so the larvae will eat mosquito larvae, and the adults will eat mosquito adults. And I can bring actually an example to mind here, which is purely anecdotal, but it was very, very startling to me. And this was a friend who was doing research into malaria mosquitoes in South Africa. And the reason why he was actually looking at dragonfly larvae was because he was surprised how little people that are trying to deal with malaria mosquitoes, how little they actually know about the ecology of these mosquitoes and of their and of their predators. So basically, you know, when they have a problem with mosquitoes, they just poison the environment, and they think they get rid of the problem. And he thought, well, that's not a very ecological thing to do, so we should actually just be looking at what is happening in the natural system, what are their predators. And so he was going around in South Africa looking at different water bodies, and what he found is that either he found a water body completely devoid of dragonfly larvae and packed with the mosquito larvae, and often these were disturbed or polluted habitats, and others he found like untouched ponds that were full of the dragonfly larvae, and there were no mosquito larvae. So it is very well possible that is an extremely important relationship. And that will, you know, that does benefit us as humans.
So once again, a different direction. When you talked about that migration, and this may be a silly question, but are the dragonflies purely individual, or when they have a migration, when they move somewhere, are they ever social? Do they go en masse, or is it just that they happen to go at the same time?
Yeah, I think it's that. Yeah. So dragonflies are not social in the sense that that bees or wasps are social. So they don't have a social system in that sense. So when you see these migrations, you see the migrations happening in swarms, But that is because, yes, large numbers of dragonflies emerge at the same time. All of them have the same problem. All of them are following the same winds. And so, yeah, they will continue to behave in swarms. But I don't think there is, you know, an active mechanism to keep them together.
That's very interesting. So what do you see? I mean, you already said that in some places dragonflies are increasing and in some places they're decreasing. What is your, at least short-term prognosis for, what is your feeling about dragonfly populations that you study? Most of the people I know who study anything in the natural world spend most of their time fighting despair and fighting depression because things are so bad. I mean, anybody working on salmon is just tearing their hair out 24 hours a day. And how are you feeling about dragonflies generically?
I would say it's not the dragonflies per se that I despair about. I mean, obviously, there will be declines, and at the moment, we estimate that perhaps 1 in 10 species is threatened with extinction. But I sort of try to turn it around and think of what dragonflies mean to me and what, you know, why I became interested in dragonflies in the first place and why I do what I do, which is basically write field guides and, you know, make dragonflies accessible to people. And initially I was doing that, you know, I was writing these books, I was exploring these areas because dragonflies are beautiful and because the places where they brought me are beautiful. And then I realized that, you know, why, you know, that basically what I was doing was finding a way to translate and transport that satisfaction to other people so that they could have the same experience. So that through the beauty of dragonflies that is undeniable and the sensitivity of dragonflies that it's also undeniable, I realized that they were like a perfect metaphor of what nature is for us. And so then I realized, oh, that's actually why I'm doing what I'm doing. So even though I do despair, not so much about the individual dragonfly that is declining, but about, you know, whenever I go, in Africa, I work mostly in Africa, and in Africa, things are changing so rapidly. It's almost like the last continent that we're going to destroy, and I see the individual moments of destruction: a new road, a forest that gets cleared, a new dam, whatever. And it's not like I then worry about that one particular population of that one particular species. It's more the general picture, but I then just want to translate my fascination into something, you know, that other people can use and hope that you, you know, through the beauty and sensitivity of that group that I love so much and that I think they can learn to love, that they just, you know, the people just become a bit more aware and a bit less selfish. So that's how I sort of want to try to turn it around and try to be positive about it.
And how can, I mean, apart from doing what you're doing already, or in addition to it, how can you and we and all of us help to awaken, and how can dragonflies help to awaken that among people? What do you want people to do to help awaken that sense of love that you have had since you were at least 12 years old for the natural world and specifically for dragonflies? How can that help to be awakened?
Go outside and look. That's all people need to do. People, it baffles me. I often saw, you know, so often you see like children that are so fascinated by, you know, by the insect that they see in the garden or the flowers, you know, they're and so often you see that is lost as kids grow up and go to school and become overly concerned about what people think of them and what they should be doing in the future. And, you know, somehow, they lose that childlike curiosity. And that is basically what we need to hold on to. And we all have it in us, in ourselves. And I think we're all naturalists, you know, in our hearts. We all evolved, you know, as naturalists, hunter-gatherers that needed to know. We needed to know our species. We needed to know how to recognize stuff and to observe it and to know where to find it. And so we all have that in our genetic makeup to observe and to appreciate that stuff. And instead of, you know, locking ourselves up, all we need to do basically is go outside and maybe get a little nudge of awareness from people that write books like me, or that, you know, are on radio shows, telling people to open their eyes. But yeah, basically if everybody takes their children out, takes their friends out, and just exposes themselves to nature, because it is pretty bad out there, but there's still so much beauty to be seen everywhere, and in most cases not too far away, and often even in the city. And so in a way, you know, it's not very hard. It's that is just a matter of focusing elsewhere.
And dragonflies are dramatic, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, there is in a different sense, there is that same beauty. I grew up around grasshoppers too when I was a kid and through most of my life. And it wasn't until I was, 5 or 6 years ago that I first saw a dragonfly laying her eggs. And it was extraordinary. What she did is she dug a little hole, quite like a sea turtle, and then she put her behind down in the hole, her ovipositor, and she then laid her eggs and then she covered it over. It was quite like a sea turtle. It was extraordinary and beautiful. Or, back to dragonflies, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life is I sat and watched the entire process of a larvae crawling up a blade of grass and then busting its skin, and then I just sat there next to it for, I don't know, a couple hours, I guess, while its wings unfurled, and then they hardened, and then it eventually flew. No, it didn't fly away. That was in the evening, and it flew away the next morning. But the point is, it doesn't matter whether you're looking at a willow tree or a dragonfly. I mean, there is so much beauty.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. So for example, if you would, let's say, dig a pond in your backyard, you know, maybe you're not doing, you know, that much for dragonflies per se, because, you know, the species that can breed in your pond are the species that can breed in any pond, and they're actually not the species that are threatened. But that's not really the reason why you're putting the pond there. The reason you're putting the pond there is because you can attract dragonflies to your garden, and you can see what you just described. You can follow the seasons. You can see the dragonflies appear. You can see the dragonflies arrive if they're migratory species. You can see them emerge. You can see the succession of the vegetation. You can see other people, other species appear. You can see the interaction. You can see with other species, with the frogs, with the mosquitoes, all the things we've been talking about. You know, if you're digging a pond in your garden for dragonflies, that is the real reason, you know, to bring nature a little bit closer to you. And as I said, you know, the words that you quoted right in the beginning, that is what I like so much about dragonflies. It's not about humans. It's about nature.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I think I made my point.
So is there anything else you want to say about dragonflies before we end?
Wow, that's a very general question. I'm just reminded now of one time this dragonfly expert. He taken us out in the Alps for a few days to look at dragonflies, and then we said goodbye, and his last words were "dragonflies forever," and it was just so random but so true that that is now the first thing that came up with me. Dragonflies forever, nature forever.
Well, thank you. Go ahead.
they're just the most amazing things. They're just the most, you know, the perfect expressions of the beauty and sensitivity of nature. You know what I've said now a few times. And so I would like to say to anyone who's listening, who hasn't bothered, you know, to go and sit along a river or by a stream or by a pond, just to observe them and just to see how amazing they are. And I think that's all I need to say.
Well, thank you so much for all that, and thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been K.D. Dykstra. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.